U.S. President Trump says he's done a great thing in pulling the U.S. out of Syria, but one foreign affairs expert says he's ceding American power to a big enemy. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports from the White House.
As he claimed success, the president was quick to note the withdrawal was hammered just a few weeks ago.
Now people are saying, wow. What a great outcome.
Seth Jones at the Center for Strategic and International Studies says it is, but not for the U.S.
It is the Russians.
Jones says Vladimir Putin's filling the vacuum the U.S. created by leaving Syria, just the latest toehold Putin's grabbed in the region.
Virtually every major country in the Middle East now has to go through Moscow as part of its political and military deliberations. Not Washington.
Sagar Magani at the White House.
The U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Service is canceling harsh six-figure fines against illegal immigrants who have taken refuge in churches across the United States. Under a 1996 law, migrants who have failed to heed deportation orders are fined between $300,000 and $500,000. As part of his drive to crack down on illegal immigration, U.S. President Donald Trump signed an executive order in 2017 directing the agency to start collecting that money. But a coalition of immigration lawyers and rights groups representing seven targeted women living in churches called the fines illegal. As Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg addressed U.S. lawmakers' concerns Wednesday about the planned launch of a global digital currency, House Financial Services Committee Chairwoman Maxine Waters renewed her call to halt the launch and even suggested the company should be broken up. During testimony before the committee, Zuckerberg acknowledged the planned 2020 rollout is a risky project, but said the cryptocurrency would provide a secure method for millions of Americans who don't have bank accounts to make low-cost fund transfers. This is VOA News. Democrats pursuing their impeachment inquiry of U.S. President Donald Trump demanded Wednesday that the State Department release key documents they had subpoenaed about his efforts to pressure Ukraine to open investigations to help him politically. The proceedings were interrupted by congressional members of President Trump's party. More from VOA's Lattice Ahok.
A group of Republican lawmakers stormed a closed-door deposition in the House Intelligence Committee space. The lawmakers were not members of the congressional panels conducting the investigation and had no right to demand entry, but they argued that the case was too important for the investigations to be held behind closed doors.
We are trying to have some transparency to this process. I represent nearly a million Floridians who are asking me my thoughts on this process, and yet I can't relay to them anything except what's being leaked to the media.
The disturbance delayed the scheduled deposition by several hours. Critics say the upheaval was created to distract public attention from the damage inflicted by a deposition given to lawmakers Tuesday by former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Bill Taylor.
That's VOA's Lattice Ahok reporting. European Union leaders are deciding on another extension to Britain's exit from the bloc after lawmakers in Britain frustrated Prime Minister Boris Johnson's plan to leave this month. Henry Ridgewell reports for VOA.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson insisted Wednesday that his plan is still to leave on 31st October.
I don't think the people of this country want a delay. I don't want a delay. I intend to press on, but I'm afraid we now have to see what our EU friends will decide on our behalf.
Johnson was forced by law to ask the EU for an extension, even though he didn't want one, after failing to pass his Brexit deal in Parliament last Saturday. The British leader then tried to rush the legislation through Parliament with just days to go before the deadline. While agreeing to the deal in principle, MPs Tuesday voted against this timetable. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Chinese manufactured drones purchased by the Pentagon months after their use was prohibited due to cybersecurity concerns. And they're being used as targets and are not being deployed with elite U.S. forces on missions. That's according to a Pentagon official. A VOA investigation last month revealed the U.S. Air Force and Navy had spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on drones made by market leader Daxiang Innovations for some of the military's most sensitive and secretive operators, including the Air Force's only Special Tactics Wing and Navy Sea Air Land teams. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The World Food Program makes first visit in 9 years to Sudan's Nuba Mountains.
First, I want to thank the international community for the first time to be alerted to see the issue of the Nuba Mountains, which is one of the major isolated locations in Sudan.
Dr. Yasser Khoury is the Secretary General of the Nuba Mountains Association, USA. There are mixed opinions about forming a unity government in South Sudan by the November 12 deadline. We will talk with two members of a parliamentary delegation from the Democratic Republic of Congo. And the International Organization of African Nurses will launch this Saturday in Dallas, Texas.
The International Organization of African Nurses is a not-for-profit organization with one objective, bringing together nurses and healthcare professionals of African descent with one goal, moving nursing and healthcare in Africa forward.
Dr. Elvis Njia is the president of the organization. A Nigerian polio survivor gives hope to thousands. And we'll talk with the founder of a website where African women share their experiences about their sexuality. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. World Food Program, WFP, Wednesday made its first visit in 9 years to Sudan's Nuba Mountains. This came after Sudan's Council of Ministers granted permission to WFP Executive Director David Beasley to visit Kaouda in the Nuba Mountains of South Kordofan. The conflict in Nuba Mountains began when a Nuba ethnic group launched a protest in 2011 after Ahmed Haroun was named governor of Sudan's state of South Kordofan. The people of South Kordofan believed that Sudan People's Liberation Movement, SPLM nominee Abdel Aziz Al-Haidu, should have won after Sudanese armed forces took the state capital, Kadugli, and there were reports of mass killings amounting to ethnic cleansing. Dr. Yasser Khoury is Secretary General of the Nuba Mountains Association, USA.
First, I want to thank the international community for the first time to be alerted and have their attention, special attention, to see the issue of the Nuba Mountains, which is one of the major isolated locations in Sudan. Commander Abdelaziz, one of the high command in the Nuba Mountains, has met with the director for the World Food Program to discuss about the possibility, how they're going to do something to help and save the people of the Nuba Mountain for the first time in the history. And I'm delighted that the issue now is going to be alerted by the international community.
But you will understand that the reason that perhaps that international organizations like the World Food Program has not been there because of conflict. Do you think things are getting better in terms of the conflict?
The conflict is still massively exists, but in our side, especially the SPLA control area, now SPLA continue to declare ceasefire, even though the area has been bombarded throughout years and years. But after the Sudan civil disobedience program erupted, all the ceasefire all over the area there has been declared. People are looking forward to hear what was civilian demand, what's going on there. Even though the government, official government of Sudan, did not declare the ceasefire, but the rebel area, the ceasefire was being declared since 6 months, and then it has been extended another 3 months, and it has been extended another 3 months, almost a year. There is a calm. The weather and atmosphere is very calm now because of what's going on now. In adding to that, there is a negotiation going on in Juba, which is hosted by the government of South Sudan, to discuss about what's going to happened after the new transitional government, the civilian transitional government headed by the Sovereign Council, Sovereign Military Council in Sudan. They are now meeting with rebel and all the groups to discuss about the possibility to end the war in those affected.
You are Executive Director of Sudan Hope Project and also Secretary General of the Nuba Mountains International Association. We are here talking about the fact that organizations like the World Food Program have not been to the Nuba Mountains, and just this week they have gone there. What does your organization do, and in the absence of these organizations, these international organizations?
Wonderful question. Due to the war and the conflict that takes place in that area, I dedicated myself as head of these organizations to help people who are run away from the war and they end up in refugee camps in the neighboring countries such as South Sudan, Uganda, and Kenya. I supported these people there by carrying medical aid and educational project to support those children that are orphans and widows.
Dr. Yasser Khoury, thank you very much, doctor. It's so nice to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Yasser Khoury is the Secretary General of the Sudan Numba Mountains Association, USA. He was speaking with us from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, USA. Analysts have mixed views about forming a unity government in South Sudan by the November 12 deadline. While some say a unity government should be formed soon, others have a more nuanced response, saying any decision to delay its formation should only be made after careful consideration about the ramifications of such a decision. Winnie Sirino has more from Juba.
Abraham Kwalnyon, an associate professor of politics, peace and security at the University of Juba, says the urging of the United Nations Security Council to form a unity government by November 12 is a positive step forward. However, he says given that other pre-transitional tasks, including security arrangements, are yet to be implemented, the forming of a unity government must be handled carefully so it does not lead to another war.
South Sudan is at the critical juncture because this movement could either lead to the eruption of conflict at larger scales or it could lead to the transformation of the conflict at large. This means that the coming of the United Nations Security Council to Juba is a welcome move. It shows to the citizens of South Sudan that the international community is having concern and have the people of South Sudan at heart.
Nguyen says neither the international community or the South Sudanese people want any more extensions of the pre-transitional period. He says forming the government by November 12th is a way of building trust among the warring leaders. Nguyen says Machar's comment that he would not be part of any government by November 12th could not exactly mean that he is opting out of the formation of the government.
The fact that Riek said if the government is formed, the cessation of hostility that has seemed to be holding for the last 1 year will not hold any longer, that is a white lie. Because the fact remains that if the government is not formed, in fact, this is what may bring the problem. Because the people of South Sudan, all eyes are set on 12 November 2019. And if there is anything that is going to change that, it should come as a united voice from the principal signatories.
James Cook, a senior research fellow and political analyst at the Juba-based Center for Strategic Policy Studies, says it is difficult to form a government by November 12th because the reality on the ground does not match what is written in the text of the peace agreement.
It is good that they have pledged, particularly the incumbent Tigono, which has the top responsibility of financing the activities of the security sector, the security mechanism, and also of financing the activities of governance in Chapter 1. So that support has been commended, but it has to be translated into real action on the ground.
Okuk says if the Kiir administration moves and forms the transitional government by November 12th without all signatories, then it will become an illegitimate government because it will have violated the revitalized agreement. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sereno in Juba.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton, Washington. Today is Thursday, October 24th. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 14 minutes past the hour. A number of officials from the Democratic Republic of Congo will hold two events in Washington, D.C. today, Thursday. The first event will take place at the Russell Senate Building on Capitol Hill, and the topic will focus on foreign policy, security, democracy, and human rights. The second event will take place at the Catholic University of America, and it will focus on diaspora engagement. The two members of the delegation are former DRC Information Minister Lambert Mende, and now a member of parliament, and Jean-Jacques Mamba, also a member of parliament from the opposition Movement for the Liberation of Congo. They spoke with me in our Washington studio about their visit.
We came for a parliament meeting with our colleagues of African faith to participate in a forum for international legislation in the Congress of the United States to give them some information about how things are moving in Congo.
So how do you think things are moving in the Congo? We have a new government. How are things going?
We have new government, new president, and we're expecting that things are going to be better. But this time, we have a little bit doubt about things because we have a lot of things we are hearing, like 15 billions, the tournament, war, we have violence in the east of Congo. Too much things that we are expecting that things are going to be better.
So there's $15 billion. Who's responsible for that? Did it get missing during Kabila time or during Tshisekedi time? What do you know, Minister Lambamende, member now of parliament?
It is a recent file, but still, we are in a coalition with Mr. Tshisekedi. Mr. Kabila and Mr. Tshisekedi, they decided to handle the government in a coalition. And, of course, this problem happened. And President Tshisekedi wasn't asked by your colleagues when he was touring in Europe. And he said that the justice have been given the file to inquire, and he will not interfere when justice is working on the file.
I did talk to members of the opposition. They say they are focusing on fighting corruption. Is that your aim also?
Yes, really, because, you know, we have employment rate very high in my country. And if we want to get some investors, because we have a lot of mineral, we have a good country that can product a lot of things. And if we want to receive some investors, we have to fight corruption. In the new government, it's better for us to get some strong signals that shows that things are changing. And for now, it's still like the situation is the same.
I want to get back to the reason why you are here. Who are you going to meet with? Members of the U.S. Congress?
Of course, we have to meet with colleagues in Congress to speak with them about the legislation, about Africa, about Congo. How will they be handling issues of Congo? Because there is a new situation there in Congo. We need, of course, that they be well aware of things as they are moving. We saw that many people do not understand the issue that pushed us to build a coalition between the former president and the new president, the new elected president of Congo. That is the will of our people, and we have to accept what people have decided to give to Mr. Tshisekedi presidency, but to maintain Mr. Kabila as the leader of the majority in the parliament to lead the government. This is the will of our people, that all of us, we have to join hands to build this big country in the heart of Africa.
That was former DRC Information Minister Lambamende, now a member of parliament. You also heard Jean-Jacques Mamba, also a member of parliament from the opposition movement for the liberation of Congo. The International Organization of African Nurses will launch this Saturday, October 26, in Dallas, Texas. Dr. Elvis Njia, president of the organization, says it will provide a platform where nurses, healthcare providers, organizations, students, and non-healthcare providers can collaborate to move nursing and healthcare in Africa forward.
The International Organization of African Nurses is a not-for-profit organization with one objective, bringing together nurses and healthcare professionals of African descent with one goal, moving nursing and healthcare in Africa forward. I have been in the medical field for over 9 years now, and it is an established medical fact, also in the social sciences, that when people have similar problems, when they come together, they are more likely to have better outcomes. They are more likely to have solutions that are reliable and solutions that are sustainable. If you look at the problems and challenges we have when it comes to healthcare in Africa, especially sub-Saharan Africa, what is common is these problems do not recognize our country boundaries. And so for the first time in trying to mount a solution to this problem, what we're saying is we have to disregard our differences as people or nurses or nurse practitioners or healthcare providers from different countries. We have to come together as a matter of necessity. Once we come together, we're able to start finding solutions to these problems.
You talk about fostering collaboration among stakeholders. I mean, do you intend to be collaborating with African health departments? So
yes, James, we have to do that. We had a project in Amazonia before the war. We started a test diabetes and HIV campaign, and we have to do that in collaboration with the local health departments. We cannot replace them. The goal was to test people with diabetes and HIV, and those who screened positive, we would then refer them to the Minister of Health in the local department.
Another example is we are about to start telepsychiatry in Liberia, and we have to partner with the local health department and the pharmacies to where patients would go like to a pharmacist. They would consult with a nurse that's there, and through the use of communication and electronic devices, we're able to consult with them from the United States. That's technology that we're using now. There's no reason we cannot use it with problems when it comes to our villages and cities in Africa.
How do you get your support? And would you be sending, say, nurses to Africa whenever need be?
Yes. So it is a broad-based organization to where we are not very specific when it comes to interventions. So if we do have the resources that we could use for specific interventions, we do that. And if we have a situation where we need a support staff to go there and do it, then we do it. Our first beginning stage is all we're saying is, this is a problem, this is a need, and we're needing everybody to understand that there is a shift in thinking. So the problems are similar. We just have to change the way we approach the solutions to these problems. Let me just add real quick that if anybody's listening to me, whether you are in North America or not, if you can be in Dallas on October 26th, we're inviting you to come for the launching of this organization.
Dr. Elvis Njia is the president of the International Organization of African Nurses. You're speaking with us from Dallas, Texas. 10 years ago, Nigeria accounted for half of the world's polio cases. But following an aggressive vaccination program, the country is on the verge of being declared polio-free. Despite the milestone, Nigeria's many polio survivors are left to struggle with their disabilities, although one survivor has found a way to provide support and hope for thousands. Timothy Obiezu has this story from Abuja on World Polio Day today, October 24th.
At the age of 5, Ayuba Gufwan contracted polio, which led to paralysis in both legs. Like other polio survivors, he struggled but eventually made it through school and became a lawyer. After graduating, he opened the Beautiful Gate Handicapped People's Center, which manufactures wheelchairs that are distributed for free to other polio survivors. Gufwan says his goal is to close the gap between polio eradication and rehabilitation of survivors.
We discovered then, even now, that the focus of polio eradication is prevention-centered. There was little or nothing that was done to take care and to ameliorate the suffering of polio victims.
Polio is a highly infectious viral disease that invades the nervous system and can cause total paralysis within hours. With a massive polio eradication initiative by the World Health Organization, polio cases decreased globally by more than 99% since 1988. But beyond eradication, Gufwan's center has helped about 18,000 survivors in Nigeria, Chad, Niger, and Cameroon, including Ibrahim Umar, who now works at the Beautiful Gate facility. Umar says, I started working here in 2016. Before then, I had no prior experience or training, but I have been getting a lot of help from them. Nigeria has not recorded a new single polio case in 3 years, a major improvement since 2012 when it accounted for more than half of the world's infections. But the Abuja-based disability rights advocacy group, DRAC, says 40% of Nigeria's 27 million disabled people are polio survivors. At a demonstration to raise awareness of their plight, the director of the advocacy group, Irene Patrick, says polio eradication is incomplete unless the disabilities of survivors are addressed.
Every year, whenever we're commemorating polio, the focus is on polio eradication. Make sure all children get vaccinated. Make sure children, mothers are vaccinating their children. Make sure we kick polio out. But nobody ever thinks about those who have survived polio and are living with one form of disability or the other and going through various challenges. So for us, that's also a priority.
Months ago, Nigeria's National Assembly passed into law a bill to ensure that disabled people, including polio survivors, have better access. But in the meantime, survivors like Gufwan are working to help those who have suffered the effects of polio to improve their lives. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Adventures from the Bedrooms of African Women is an online outlet where African women can share experiences of sexuality. The blog is celebrating its 10th anniversary this December in Accra. Nana Dakoa Sikiama, the website's founder, tells Ricky Stryak she hopes the festival will create a safe space where women can speak up about their experiences while learning how to enjoy their bodies.
Where we're looking at pleasure, sex, and sexualities really from a very comprehensive lens, and also recognizing the fullness of all our experiences, recognizing that, you know, sexuality is on the spectrum. There isn't just one sort of sexual experience, centering pleasure, creating spaces for women to learn about their bodies, but also creating spaces where people who may need some space to process the trauma they've experienced get to do that in a really safe environment. And so this is really what the event is about. It's also really about decentering all forms of harmful deeds, right? This is also about decentering, you know, dominance and any sort of deed that we think is harmful, and really just trying to look at pleasure, sex, and sexuality from a pluralistic lens.
What maybe some people are calling toxic masculinity, maybe decentering that kind of attitude in general?
Absolutely. And recognizing that kind of attitude is not necessarily an attitude that's just within men. It's within society, right? And it's within our systems. And so what does it mean to take away that sort of patriarchal power and really to center human beings and to center human beings living fully in their bodies and having all of the rights that we're entitled to?
When you say take away the patriarchal power, what do you mean by that? Because I think it's easy for people to see sometimes one-off experiences, but hard for people to see the big systematic structural issues that I think you are trying to address.
Absolutely. And I agree that is something that's really difficult to do, you know, which is why for me, we need spaces for communities and especially marginalized communities to come together to think about how we do this. Because even for us as individuals, there's a lot of unlearning that we have to do, right? Because we are brought up in these systems. So we buy into these systems. How do we, you know, divest from systems, right? How do we build community? How do we support one another? You know, and for me, it's also to do this from, you know, from a perspective that's pleasurable. So even the conversations around this are enjoyable, right? That we're able to have this conversation in an open fashion where we're learning from one another, where we're listening respectfully, where we may not understand an issue. This and we're just listening. We're not necessarily questioning, we're not challenging, you know, but we're really trying to stay open because, yeah, we have been taught a particular way. We have been brought up in particular ways. And I don't think we should assume that everything we've been taught is right.
Obviously, when you're ahead of your time, as it seems like you are, you're going to run into naysayers. Have you had any naysayers or any challenges?
Honestly, I really haven't faced any challenges or nothing that for me has been worth even noting. On the contrary, I feel like I experience a lot of support. And I also get, you know, individuals come up to me to tell me how much this work means to them and how important it is to create and to continue to create that space.
That was Nana Dakoa Sikiama, the founder of the website Adventures from the Bedrooms of African Women. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Accra. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Tanzania's highest court has upheld a landmark 2016 ruling that raised the minimum age of marriage to 18. The Supreme Court of Appeals decision, announced Wednesday, was greeted by child welfare and women's advocates as a win. The World Food Programme, WFP, Wednesday made its first visit in 9 years to Sudan's Numba Mountains. This came after Sudan's Council of Ministers granted permission to WFP Executive Director David Beasley to visit Kaouda in the Numba Mountains of South Kordofan. And that's it for this Thursday, October 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service at the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a lovely day.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.